Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the program, George Grow and Ana Mateo tell us what life has been like in Washington, D.C. during the federal government shutdown. Then, our program, Everyday Grammar. We close our show with our American History program, The Making of a Nation. But first,
no city experiences a government shutdown like Washington, D.C. In addition to the economic effect, a suspension of government operations affects Washington on a cultural and recreational level. It influences almost everyone, from trash collectors to young parents, and even those hoping to get married. The United States Congress and President Donald Trump have not been able to reach agreement on a spending plan. On December 22nd, about one-fourth of federal agencies had no money left and were forced to close. Trump wants Congress to approve $5 billion to build a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico. He says this would help strengthen national security. Democratic Party leaders oppose his spending request and the idea of a border wall. The local District of Columbia government has continued operations without a federal budget in place, as Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser had promised.
The economic situation is not good. Some studies estimate that the federal government directly employs more than 364,000 people in and around Washington, D.C. This includes Northern Virginia and Southern Maryland. The district alone contains more than 102,000 jobs in government agencies that have no money to finance operations. Deputy City Administrator Kevin Donahue compared the shutdown to the main factory closing in a small industrial town. He noted that the closure has affected service industries like restaurants, food trucks, and taxis. What keeps us up at night is not the work we know we have to do in weeks 1 and 2, Donahue said. It is the unpredictable effects of weeks 4 and 5 and onward, he said, with the possibility for mass restaurant closures or federal workers missing payments on housing or car loans.
Most immediately, the shutdown created a public health problem. The U.S. National Park Service oversees many parts of D.C., from the world-famous National Mall to green spaces like DuPont Circle and even neighborhood parks. Washington waste collection crews now empty waste containers at the city's more than 120 separate NPS sites, 3 times a day in the case of the containers at the National Mall. That service costs at least $54,000 a week. Donahue said there is an unofficial agreement dating back to earlier shutdowns that the local government will be repaid when the federal government reopens. The Park Service recently announced it would use other money to restart its own trash collection at some of the Washington sites. For years, Washington has had a tortured relationship with the federal government, which can change or block any local law. Now, city officials seemingly have the chance to note the irony of the shutdown. They often claim they are treated by Congress as if they are unable to govern the city. Now, they are taking over and covering for the central government. When the federal government shuts down, we step up, Bowser said during a January 4th press conference.
The shutdown also affects the 700,000 people who call Washington, D.C. home. The Smithsonian Institution's many museums, including the National Zoo, closed their doors about a week into the shutdown. The John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts has severely cut back its hours of operation. On a recent rainy weekend, parents and children gathered outside the Bloombars Cultural Center in Washington's Columbia Heights neighborhood. They formed a line stretching halfway up the street for the usual Saturday morning children's drumming class. The crowd was three times larger than the normal size. The reason? Parents searching for something to occupy their children in a city where more than 10 free museums and the zoo have been closed. It happens every time, laughed Bloombars founder John Chambers, who recalls a similar increase during the 2013 shutdown, which lasted 16 days. The district is filled with shutdown specials, offering federal employees everything from food and drinks to live theater and medical marijuana at low or no cost to them.
Another effect of the shutdown is the closure of the D.C. office that registers marriages. Bowser told the Associated Press that even she was surprised to learn that people could not get marriage licenses because Congress pays for the local court system. Bowser quickly reached out to allies on the Council of the District of Columbia to pass emergency legislation called the Let Our Vows Endure Act. The measure gives her administration the right to approve marriage licenses. At a recent event to sign the act into law, Bowser said, "Just so my team knows, we're probably going to want to keep that power." Nobody laughed, and she did not seem to be joking. I'm George Grow.
And I'm Anna Mateo.
When I lived in Portugal, one of the simplest things to do was really hard for me: ordering food at restaurants. I worried about being laughed at or not being understood. Often, I said just the name of the food and please instead of full sentences. Ordering food in a foreign language can be frightening. But in today's everyday grammar, we'll give you some expressions and suggestions for ordering at American restaurants. Let's begin with greetings. When ordering food in any restaurant, it's a good idea to greet the person taking your order. You can say things like, "Hi," or "Hi there," "Hello," "Good morning," "Afternoon," or "Evening," or "How's it going?" In the United States, asking someone you've never met how it's going is just a friendly way of saying hello. The language we use to order food usually depends on the kind of restaurant. Is it a casual place where you order at a counter? Or is it a full-service restaurant where a server comes to your table and takes your order? Let's listen to four common expressions used at American counter service restaurants. Imagine that you want to order tea.
Can I get a medium tea, please?
Can I order a medium tea, please?
I'll take a medium tea, please.
I'll have a medium tea, please.
The expressions I'll have and I'll take are useful at both counter service restaurants and full service restaurants. Listen to someone ordering food at a counter. Hi there, how can I help you?
Hi, how's it going? I'll take a medium tea and a toasted whole wheat bagel with vegetable spread.
The worker might respond with one of these questions. Do you want anything else with that? Will that be all for you today? If your answer is no to the first question or yes to the second, they might say this next. Is that for here or to go? They are asking whether you will eat at the restaurant or take the food away to eat elsewhere. The appropriate response is
to go, please,
or
for here, thanks.
Okay, let's move to full-service restaurants. These can range from very casual to very formal. At casual restaurants, you usually do not need a table reservation. But at very busy restaurants and for formal dining, you often do. At places where no reservations are needed, a host or hostess will greet you at the door with something like this. Hi, welcome to Paprika. Party of how many? They are asking how many people are in your group. Or they may simply count your group and confirm the number. Party of four? Or table for four? At places that require reservations, if you are the first of your group to arrive, tell the host what name the reservation is in and the time. For example,
Hi, I'm here for the 7:45 reservation for Bryant.
If some of your group members have not yet arrived, you will likely have to wait to be seated. Okay, so imagine that you are now seated with your group. Here's what a server might say when they first come to your table. Hi, my name is Alice, and I'll be your server today. Our special today is a tasty vegetable gumbo. Can I start you off with something to drink? If you're ready, you can respond.
Yes, I'll have an orange juice.
Yes, I'd like an orange juice.
When they return with your drinks, they'll likely check whether you're ready to order food or have questions. Do you have any questions about the menu? Are you ready to order? You can tell them your questions, if any, or maybe you're unsure what to order. In that situation, ask for a suggestion, more details, or more time.
I'm having trouble deciding. What would you recommend?
Can you tell me more about today's special? What's in it?
We just need a few more minutes, please.
Okay, now imagine you've enjoyed your meal. It's time to pay your bill. You can use eye contact to catch the server's attention, or just raise your hand halfway when they look in your direction. Here are three ways to ask for the bill.
We're ready for the check, please.
Can we have the check, please?
Check, please.
If people in your group wish to pay separately, you can request separate checks. Many, but not all, restaurants offer this. And lastly, at an American restaurant, don't forget to leave a tip. A good tip is between 15 and 20%. But read your bill carefully, since some restaurants add the tip into the bill. Ordering food in a foreign language is not easy at first, but after a few tries, I promise you will feel more at ease. Here's what I suggest. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. Even if you use different expressions than you learned today, your server will probably understand you if you speak clearly. Also, don't be afraid to ask the server to repeat themselves if their words are unclear or they speak too quickly. Enjoy your meal. I'm Alice Bryant.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. 1852 was a presidential election year in the United States. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Baltimore, Maryland. The meeting opened in June of 1852. Delegates agreed that a man must win two-thirds of the convention's votes to be the Democratic candidate. On the first ballot, no one received two-thirds of the vote, so the voting continued. Finally, on the 47th ballot, support began to increase for someone considered an unlikely candidate. His name was Franklin Pierce. Pierce was from the northeastern state of New Hampshire. He was a lawyer and former state lawmaker. He also had served in the United States Senate and House of Representatives. He became an officer in the Army during the U.S. War with Mexico. On the 49th ballot, Pierce won the Democratic nomination. He would be the party's candidate for president.
Pierce was a passionately loyal adherent of the Democratic Party and of its principles of negative governance domestically and spread eagle expansionism in foreign affairs.
Historian Michael Holt wrote a book about Franklin Pierce. Mr. Holt describes Pierce as someone who was like most Democrats at the time. In other words, he did not think the federal government should intervene much in efforts to help build up and develop the nation. But he wanted the United States to play a big and powerful role internationally. Naturally, Democrats did not agree on every policy issue. In 1852, the party was sharply divided on whether the government should or could permit slavery to continue in the United States. But Democrats decided to limit their fighting with each other during the election campaign, and they all agreed to support Pierce. The Whig Party held its presidential nominating convention in Baltimore 2 weeks after the Democrats met. The same thing that happened at the Democratic convention now happened at the Whig convention. Delegates voted over and over again, but no man got enough votes to win. It took 53 ballots before one of the men, General Winfield Scott, won the nomination. On election day, Pierce won a crushing victory. The Democrats won not only the presidency, but also strong majorities in Congress. The Democrats' victory was so great that many people thought the Whig Party was finished. In fact, many Whigs themselves hoped their party was destroyed. Like the Democrats, Whigs disagreed with each other about slavery. Northern Whigs wanted to form a new anti-slavery party, and Southern Whigs wanted to form a party that would better represent their interests. The Whigs lost badly in the 1852 elections because, unlike the Democrats, they were not able to bridge the differences between their Northern and Southern members. Franklin Pierce was 48 years old when he took office. He was the youngest man yet to be elected president. He was charming and made friends easily, but those who knew Pierce best worried about him. They knew that under all his friendly charm, he was a weak man. They feared the duties and problems of the presidency would be too great for him to deal with. Pierce also faced a difficult situation in his personal life. Two of his children had died when they were babies. A third child was killed in a train accident shortly before Pierce moved to the White House. In addition, his wife, Jane, did not like living in Washington, D.C. She did not support her husband's campaign for presidency. Years earlier, she had urged him to resign from the Senate and return to New Hampshire. She did not want to go back to Washington. When her husband was elected, she agreed to live there, but she rarely saw anyone. One of her close friends took her place at public events. Historian Michael Holt says Franklin Pierce's main goal as president was to keep his party united. One way to maintain party unity was to adopt popular Democratic policies. He promised strong support for expanding the territory of the United States. He also promised a strong foreign policy. During his term in office, Pierce successfully negotiated with Britain to gain American fishing rights along the coast of Canada. He also supported diplomatic and trade talks with Japan. However, he was unsuccessful in an attempt to buy Cuba from Spain. National issues presented President Pierce with a more difficult problem. Now that the election was over, some Democrats felt it was time once again to raise the issue of slavery. The Compromise of 1850 had settled the question of slavery only in the Western territories. But anti-slavery activists said the compromise should have done more to end slavery throughout the country. And pro-slavery activists said the agreement did not protect slave owners' rights. They did not want the federal government to intervene in slavery anywhere. As president in 1853, Pierce had to choose between the competing sides. He could support the Compromise of 1850 and say the dispute over slavery was settled. Or Pierce could try to make peace with both anti- and pro-slavery extremists. Giving the extremists jobs in his administration would be the easy way to satisfy their demands. And that was the policy Pierce chose.
Contemporaries at the time predicted that this attempt to share the plums would wreck the party, and it did.
Historian Michael Holt says Pierce sought to include men from competing sides of the Democratic Party in his cabinet. Pierce named William Marcy of New York as Secretary of State. Marcy wanted to limit the spread of slavery and keep the Union together. Jefferson Davis of Mississippi was named Secretary of War. Davis, more than any other man, represented Southern slave owners. He threatened to take the South out of the Union if the government set any limits on slavery. Caleb Cushing of Massachusetts was named Attorney General. Although a Northerner, Cushing was a friend of many Southerners. He was a very able man, but his loyalties were not clear. James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was named Minister to Britain. All these men had strong ideas about the future of the United States. President Pierce found it difficult to control them. One senator even said the administration should not have been called the Pierce administration because Pierce did not lead it. He said it was an administration of enemies of the Union who used the president's name and power for their own purposes. As president, Franklin Pierce faced another difficult question. Where should the United States build its new railroads? The country had expanded, and white settlers were moving west. Many were hungry for good transportation. They wanted railroads that reached across the continent from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. Engineers decided that four new rail lines would be possible. They could cross the southern, central, or northern parts of the United States. Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, a Democrat, proposed that three of the lines be built. He said the government could give land to the railroad companies. The companies could then sell the land to get the money they needed to build the lines. A Senate committee discussed the issue. Its members proposed that only one railroad line be built. But which one? Many congressmen believed a southern line would be best. There would be little snow in winter, and the railroad would cross lands that were already organized as states or official territories. A northern or central line would face severe winter weather, and it would have to cross a large, wild area called Nebraska. Nebraska was neither a state nor a territory. As a result, it did not yet have a local government that could support a railroad. In addition, many congressmen did not want Nebraska to develop a government. The reason, once again, was slavery. Michael Holt says members of President Pierce's party hoped the effort to organize Nebraska would unite Democrats once again. Instead, Mr. Holt says the Nebraska Territory caused more conflicts and ruined Pierce's administration. The bill increased divisions between Democrats and Whigs and between pro-slavery activists and anti-slavery abolitionists, and it brought the country one step closer to civil war. As one Northerner wrote, it was said hundreds of years ago that a house divided against itself cannot stand. The truth of this saying is written on every page in history. It is likely that the history of our own country may offer fresh examples to teach this truth to future ages.
And that's our show for today. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, with more stories from around the world. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.